Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Tonight we dig, we burrow way down deep through the rabbit hole, through the looking glass, into a netherworld of shadows and mirrors where nothing is quite what it seems. If we're ever going to have a show that might be problematic enough to justify being sabotaged, knocked off the air, this might be the one. You'll understand why once we jump into the heart of the multiple mysteries we'll be pursuing tonight. Dark stuff, creepy and disturbing, not because it's about some kind of monster from outer space or creature from some black lagoon, but rather because it shines light on the people who really pull the levers of power, those who now run the omnipresent surveillance state. I don't think someone's really going to knock us off the air. I'm just saying that mostly as a kind of insurance that something won't go wrong since we're now on notice. But I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised, and you'll understand why in a little bit. Imagine this. What if you had the ability to make yourself invisible? And I don't mean just like invisible to radar, like an airplane, but invisible, actually invisible. A cloak that would cover not just trucks or ships or planes, but people who could wear an amazing invisibility cloak and then really mess with everyone else. What if the technology was in the hands of intelligence agencies or assorted spooks, accountable to almost no one? You can imagine the mischief that could be unsettling or unleashed on the civilian population. Mind games make us think we're going crazy, send us right up the wall. Hardly a week goes by when I don't get emails or letters from people who tell me they are the victims of electronic surveillance or harassment. Some say they're being followed by people they don't know for reasons they can't fathom. Gang stalking, some people call it. In general, I don't give this a lot of credence because mostly the people who contact me seem to come across as a little bit unbalanced, and maybe they are, or maybe that's the point, to make them look like they're not quite right in the head. And just maybe it's an exercise, a form of social control, experiments that might be used on a wider scale one of these days if they're proven effective in certain controlled situations on specific targets. After I read the book that we're going to be discussing tonight, I had to rethink my position on gang stalking, electronic mind control allegations, and maybe you will too. The book is called Camellio. The author, Robert Guffey, provides excruciating detail about a long, strange trip described by some reviewers of the book as a mix of Hunter S. Thompson and Philip K. Dick, and I would add Ian Fleming. Spies and lies and high tech, where the stakes are huge, no one can be trusted, and you can never quite believe your own eyes. It's a mind-bending story, funny in places, but ultimately very unsettling, because if it's true, and the author swears it is true, then it ties together a lot of mysteries that we have pursued on this program, and it lands squarely on some turf that is familiar to me in particular, and some characters that I know well, and so do you. And if it's really going on, it's just, it's messed up, that's what it is, and I think you're going to agree with that. Robert Guffey will join us 1 hour from now, and I think it's an interview and a subject you'll be talking about for a long time to come. Greetings go out to those enjoying the Mothman Festival this weekend. It's underway this weekend in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, home of the infamous Mothman sightings, of course, made famous by John Keel and other Fortean writers. Hope it was a great turnout, and if there were any Mothman sightings or other weird happenings, I hope someone back there will let us know about it. We'll mention it on the air. Our webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of oddities and items culled from various news sources around the planet. We call it Knapp's News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast website. One story of interest, some suggestions on how to tell if a viral story is a hoax, some simple questions and tests you can ask or determine yourself that should help you decide if stuff you read online is a bunch of bunk. An example. Have you heard the allegations that the murders on live television back a couple of weeks ago, those two TV journalists who were gunned down, that was all a hoax. That was a false flag. Some of the loved ones of the murder victims have been pummeled through social media. People saying, asking them, how dare they pretend to grieve? Folks, sometimes we can take this stuff too far. We also have a story. We have a story about the Roanoke Truthers. Also there, a fascinating story about the death of former CIA chief William Colby. Remember that name? Was it a murder? Pretty intriguing evidence that hasn't really been discussed publicly, and it tends to fit with our central topic tonight if you think about it. Also there, a piece about scientific advances in invisibility tech. Exactly what we're talking about. Companies that are getting very close to making it happen in the private sector, that is, which makes you wonder, if corporations are about to make this public, how far ahead is the military on the same research? You know, usually on stuff like this, they're 20 or more years ahead of private industry, right? We don't hear about these breakthroughs until the Pentagon is on to something else. Keep that in mind as we jump into the conversation tonight. That and more in the NAPS News section on the Coast website. While you're there, maybe check out how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a terrific deal. A pennies a day give you access to the program anytime, day or night. You can listen on any device you want, and a huge archive of previous programs are at your fingertips. One other mention. Did you see the news story this week about scientists in the UK saying they use these super powerful magnets to capture and contain what they say is a living entity that was found in space? They say it's the first confirmed ET organism. You didn't see the story? Probably because it got hardly any press in this country at all. The lead scientist on this project, astrobiologist and professor Dr. Milton Wainwright, says this is the real deal and he can prove it. And in just a moment, he will join us live from the UK to talk about his discovery. So with that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, lock the door, turn up the lights and the volume. Put on a pot of Joe and shimmy into those jammies and slippers. Plop yourself into that Barca lounger, because in a moment, we begin. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I read this headline. Someone sent me a link to this story, and here's what I read. It says, staggering picture of extraterrestrial organism is proof of alien life, scientists claim. It's in a British newspaper, The Express. And you would think a headline like that would get all kinds of media attention. I don't know about you, but I didn't see much of it. I saw this link, and that was about it. And it's too bad, because the folks doing this research that led to this amazing headline are very credible scientists. Dr. Milton Wainwright is a professor at the University of Buckingham Center for Astrobiology. He recently researched the question, does life exist in space, and does it continually arrive from this source? He also remains active in researching the history of biology, notably antibiotics, and he joins us now live from the UK to talk about his research. Dr. Wainwright, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Did this get much coverage in the UK? Because it didn't get much here.
No, we've been doing this work now since 2013, so it's not new. We have had a tremendous amount of internet coverage, as you've probably seen. So if you put my name on the internet, you'll find a fantastic amount of information. But no, it's not hit the regular newspapers yet.
Well, tell me about the discovery, what you've used, I mean, how these super powerful magnets that are mentioned in the article, how you used them and what you found.
Yeah. Well, as I say, it goes back to 2013. At that time, we were working with Indian scientists, and we were sending balloons to the stratosphere. Now, we're sending these balloons to about 41 kilometers, that's 25 miles, that's a long way up, right? That's, if you imagine taking a jumbo jet, that means you take off, you cruise, you take off again, you cruise, you take off again, you cruise, and so on, four times. And we were finding bacteria at these altitudes, and we spent a lot of time working on this, and of course the media, the other scientists were saying they have contamination. A number of people have now kind of repeated the work, so we're pretty certain that bacteria exist at 41 kilometers.
So, I mean, why explain to me why it could not be contamination from something down here on Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, since then, we've done a lot of work, starting in 2013, using small balloons. And in these balloons, we go up to 27 kilometers. Now, The important thing, basically what we do is we have these samplers on the balloon, right? The sampler opens up in the stratosphere on GPS or whatever, and the material in the stratosphere lands on these samplers. And we take these little stubs, these little black stubs that we have on the sampler, inside the sampler, and we put them in an electron microscope, a very high-powered electron microscope. And we look at these, what we find. Now, when we first did this, I wasn't expecting a great deal. I wasn't expecting to find much, but the images we got were amazing. Starting in 2013, we found these very unusual organisms on our samplers from the stratosphere. Now, everyone, of course, is saying they're coming up from Earth, because Earth is covered in biology, covered in life. So obviously, the obvious place for them to come from is Earth. Now, the big clincher as to why they don't come from Earth is we don't find any pollen, we don't find any grass, we don't find any fungal spores of the same size on the sampler. Now, if these strange organisms were coming up from Earth, they'd be covered in pollen grains, and they're not. So this is one of the reasons why we think they're coming in from space. They're incoming rather than outgoing.
And I guess another reason would be there's nothing quite like it. There's nothing that's ever been discovered. At some level, I mean, you've made a discovery of one kind or another.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because the critic could say, well, they've not been discovered because they're in a hole somewhere in the Mojave Desert. It's just a matter of time. Now, the other main reason why we think they're coming in, is that some of the organisms cause impact events. They create little craters on the surface of the sampler. Now, if they were coming from Earth, they'd be fighting gravity. They wouldn't cause these impact events. These impact events must be caused by an object traveling at speed. And if they're traveling at speed, they're coming in from space to Earth.
I think I read in one of the articles that it said they're too big to have been carried up from the Earth into space.
That's right. If you do kind of modeling, and most physicists will agree that any particle bigger than 5 microns, that's very small, any particle bigger than 5 microns can't cross the barrier from the atmosphere to the stratosphere. Now, some of these particles are 50 microns, so that's 10 times bigger than the theoretical limit. Now, of course, some critics might say, well, there must be a mechanism we don't know about. That's possible, I guess. But for the moment, it seems to be impossible that anything this big could actually go from Earth to the stratosphere. Now, one exception to that is possibly a really violent volcano, but we do our sampling 2 years after the last known volcano, and the idea behind that is that in 2 years, the particles from a volcano would have sedimented from the stratosphere. So we remain confident that we've sampled these organisms in the stratosphere. They're not contaminants, by the way. That's a load of nonsense. People keep on saying that. And because of the fact there's no pollen, there's no contamination from Earth, because they're causing impact events, they're coming in. They're coming in from space all the time. As we speak, when you walk out, there are these organisms coming in.
Would you describe the photo that it was accompanied, the Express article that I saw?
We've published, I don't know about, an important point here. This work is published in peer-reviewed journals, right? It's not...
Right.
Published in Mickey Mouse journals. It's not published in UFO journals, nothing like that, but it is a scientific endeavor. It's published in peer review. And the photograph I've shown, I mean, some people call it the snail particle. It's an organic particle, a living organism, with what look like little antennae, like a snail coming out of its shell. I originally referred to it as the cow particle because it looks a bit like a cow with two horns.
Yeah.
by the way, I give these particles names not because I think it's a cow or a snail, but just for the purpose of illustration, you know, talking about them. It makes it easier than talking about particle 7-9 stroke, whatever. So I give these particles names, and this one I thought looked like a cow. Now, what's interesting about this thing is that it's definitely organic, it's definitely biological, and it's stuck to a square crystal. And that square crystal, we can determine by X-ray analysis, is sodium chloride, it's salt. So this biological entity, excuse me, I've got a bit of a frog this morning, this biological entity is attached to a salt crystal. And again, the mass of a salt crystal means that it's very unlikely that a salt crystal could be taken to these heights. It must be incoming from space.
You also have rare earth elements, I guess, right, that have been attached to this thing?
That's right. Again, this is a new discovery. No, people have been looking at particles in the stratosphere, so-called Brownian particles. Most of the particles are inorganic. They come from space. They're inorganic space dust, cosmic dust. And we can see those clearly. We know that they're inorganic cosmic dust, and they're very different from the ones we've got. We're talking about organic biological material. So we can differentiate between the dead and the living quite easily, and these are definitely living. And we've got, I mean, that photograph you're talking about is unusual, but we've got even more unusual things which we've put on the internet and so on, put on and received some news attention, and we publish papers on them. So if people are interested, go to the website www.miltonwainwright.com, and you can see these amazing photographs.
I want to back up to something you just said, because I know your contention is this is alien life or extraterrestrial life, but I was just going to ask whether it is actually alive, and you say it is, it's alive. I mean,
that's a little bit difficult to determine whether it's biological, right? It's life. I assume that most of it will be coming in dead, but occasionally something alive, I think, will come in. But it's traveled a long way. We think probably it comes in ice crystals, maybe from comets, who knows. But we think it comes in small ice crystals, and it's the ice crystals, actually, which cause the impact event on the sampler, the little craters. The ice crystals then kind of ablate, they dissolve or evaporate, and you're left with the organism on the impact event on the crater. So the question of whether they're alive when we sample them, one of the problems, of course, is to sample them, to look at them under the electron microscope, we cover with a very thin layer of gold. So once we've covered them with gold, we've killed them effectively. Now, if I can keep on going, one of the things that people, scientists and laymen, always say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Why don't you do these sophisticated DNA tests and so on? Now, obviously, we're doing this. We're attempting to do this. But you must remember that we're only getting like 3 or 4 particles per launch on our samplers. It's not like going out in the garden and picking up a kilogram, a pound of soil and looking at the organisms, or going to your nearest pond and taking a bucket of water. You know, we have a very few samples because each launch only gives us 2 or 3 samples. So it's like a fishing trip, and we don't know what we're going to get, and we don't know how much we're going to find. And really, it's extremely difficult to do the work which we want to do.
And I'd imagine expensive.
No, relatively cheap, actually. When we were doing our work, we used to use 30-meter balloons in the Indian work. We used to launch these things, and these things had massive, heavy sampling equipment. And those balloon launches cost us about $750,000 each, would you believe? And we did about 5 of those. This system that we have costs about $5,000 per launch. So we've really got the price down. So we can do more of them, obviously. But, I mean, obviously, everything that you launch can crash. So we have some, accidents with the balloons and so on. So it's... although we've launched about 5 now, obviously we keep on going. We're going to keep on launching as many as we can. Money is a limitation, as ever, but it's relatively cheap. But the more money we have, obviously, the more launches we can do.
So talk to me a little bit about reaction among the scientific community and your colleagues. I would assume you have support from the Center for Astrobiology, where you're a professor.
Yeah, that's right. My main location is the University of Sheffield.
Okay.
I'm a member of the astrobiology unit in Buckingham, but my main university link is with the University of Sheffield. Now, what has been the response? Amongst my colleagues, disbelief, I would say, sometimes kind of people ignore me, they regard me as a bit of a heretic, I guess. The media, I've done a reasonable job. I mean, I basically send these scientific articles to the media, and of course they have to put an alien link on it.
Sure.
So everything I send that's scientific, they have to put, you know, alien found over London, little green men coming in. So that's a little bit of a problem. Obviously, it takes the shine off the science if they're being associated with aliens, obviously. The scientific community doesn't like that. I mean, our work is bona fide science, but often it gets kind of covered with this little green man.
I understand. Yeah, we understand that pretty well.
I mean, that doesn't worry me too much because it gets the stories out in the media. Now, the scientific community as a whole has gone totally cold on this. They're not reacting to it. They're not responding. They're not telling me where I'm going wrong. Obviously, I think I'm not going wrong. And I've given this work, as well as in peer-reviewed papers, I've given it at international conferences, right? So at international conferences, people listen, and I get a good response. No one tells me where we're going wrong. But I think the general response is there's something, they don't believe it, but they can't tell me why they don't believe it. In fact, one of my colleagues said exactly that. This can't be true, but I can't tell you why it's not true. My university has been less than helpful. So I think that there's a tremendous reluctance to accept this kind of information.
That's really too bad, because you would think, wow, this could really be fun to research, to get into. And,
oh, it's tremendous fun. I'm 65 now. I'm coming to the end of my career. It's a tremendous privilege to have this, to be doing this work, and we're continuing with it for at least the next 5 years. Yeah, it's a very strange thing. You would think that every scientist in the world would kind of repeat it, try and repeat it.
It's a cover version of a Creedence classic by a seemingly unlikely combo, John Fogerty and Kid Rock, doing Born on the Bayou. I think it works, though. We're talking with Dr. Milton Wainwright from the UK about an amazing discovery that he and his colleagues have made, what appears to be an extraterrestrial organism, something they found up in space and have been analyzing here. In a moment, we will open up the phone line, see if you've got some questions for Dr. Wainwright. I've got a couple more myself. Maybe there's something else on your mind. And then at the top of the hour, Robert Guffey will be joining us to talk about his book, Chameleo. We're just getting started here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dr. Milton Wainwright about the discoveries made over the last couple of years by he and his colleagues, these minute organisms found in space. Dr. Wainwright, sorry about the abrupt ending there. You were talking about the reaction from your colleagues, and it just seems like this would really be exciting work for some young scientist to be on the cutting edge of something, and I can't understand not doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that, well, we sent all the papers to NASA, to contacts in NASA. I assume that NASA must at some point try and repeat our work because, as I said, it's very, very cheap and very quick. You could do this for a few $1,000s. So all the $1 billion they're spending sending landers and stuff to Mars, they could certainly do this for a small amount of money in a relatively short amount of time. So I assume they're repeating it. And, of course, when they do repeat it, because it's a fact, I guess, then presumably the world will take notice, because if it's got the NASA name to it, they will. But yeah, I mean, anybody can do this who has a balloon system to send. We use weather balloons. They're not complicated. Now, the sampler is complicated because it has to maintain sterility throughout the flight. And also, of course, you need access to an electron microscope. So certainly people in a university, or student groups in universities, biology departments, could repeat this work relatively easily.
You know, I understand it, though. I understand how the whole anything with the word extraterrestrial or alien attached to it is poison to mainstream scientists, because it does your career no good to pursue something that, you know.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things is we've tried to get collaboration going with various large universities, and they show an interest, and all of a sudden it goes dead. Oh, we don't want to get involved. It's too controversial. We'll lose our grants. So the grant funding thing is really the thing that's slowing science down, because too many young scientists just are scared to do anything controversial because of they might lose their grants, or they might lose their tenure or their status or whatever. Now, of course, I'm 65. I've had a 50-year career, more or less, in biology. So I don't really care about my career. I just want to continue doing this work and putting it out.
The idea of panspermia, that idea has been around a long time. It seems to, not all that revolutionary or disturbing.
That's right. Obviously it goes way back. The modern theory, which we're working on, is by Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, the famous astronomer Fred Hoyle, and Chandra Wickramasinghe, who's still alive, still with us. And we collaborate with Chandra. And Chandra has been at it since the 70s. And he has come in for a tremendous amount of racism, absolute criticism and trolling from all sides. And he's incredibly brave that he's continued with this work. Now, my wife says to me, I can't see the problem. Surely life's coming in from space, which annoys me a little bit because I'm spending all this time doing what she thinks is an obvious answer to a problem. But that's wise for you, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the Earth is an open system. There's no reason why material, we know that material, inorganic material comes in. There's no reason on Earth why living organisms could not be coming in from space all the time. There's no, it's not a greenhouse. The Earth is not covered in glass. It's not covered in polythene. It's open to material going out and coming in all the time. So yeah, panspermia seems an obvious idea. It is difficult to understand why people get so agitated about it.
Well, you know, there's, as you've noted in some of your previous interviews that I've read about, is that there's some deep cultural and religious beliefs that, both scientific and faith-based beliefs, that life began as a primordial soup down here on Earth.
That's right. And of course, NASA keeps on banging on about these, you know, prebiotic materials, the precursors of life. They don't go looking for life. They're looking for these precursors, these chemical, because they're tied in with the chemical idea that life originated from chemistry on Earth. And they really don't kind of go out of their way to look for life in space, which is rather amazing in itself, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, because if they could show there's life out there, think what their budget would be, you know? Think it would go through the roof.
On the other hand, maybe some senators from some states have been influenced by religious groups who are saying, you know, we don't want our tax dollars to be spent for looking for life in space. You know, panspermia is not in the Bible and so on. I don't know. It's a mystery. NASA is a complete mystery to me.
I mean,
what motivates NASA, I don't know.
Well, if you ever find out, please let us know.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of panspermia and a primordial soup, they're not mutually exclusive. It could be both.
That's right. Well, one assumes that life began somewhere, although even that's an assumption, because maybe, not in a religious sense, but maybe life was eternal. Life always was. But we assume, because we have a human construct to think in terms of beginnings and ends, we assume life started somewhere. And, of course, people say, well, if life began, it could begin on Earth just as well as anywhere else. But you've got far more opportunities out there. You know, the number of rocky planets is billions, zillions of these planets. So if it's a statistical event, which it would be, then there's more chance of life forming elsewhere than on a single planet called Earth. Why on Earth would anyone think that life began here? It's arrogant, and it's just statistically improbable.
Well, it's also disturbing if there is microbial life. Maybe does that increase the chances that there's intelligent life out there? Because that's the part that might
be really
uncomfortable.
Yeah, sure. If you've got life elsewhere, then that can evolve and build up to intelligent life. So that's your starting point. If there's no life out there, there's no intelligent life, obviously.
What about the argument, I'm sure you've heard it, that maybe these microbes just live in the upper atmosphere? That's their environment. That's they were born, they've been there forever.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a possibility, but they are moving at speed into us. Maybe they're falling down. The other possibility that we've mentioned is that they may have came from pre-Earth or early Earth. They may have been sent up by a super volcano or an impact event. So they've been sent out and they're coming back. So maybe they are the original life forms from Earth coming back. This is nice speculation. We don't know. So, and of course, the other idea I speculated on, and this has been taken up by the media with great relish, is the idea of what we call directed panspermia, that some of these organisms have been sent by a intelligent civilization to colonize the cosmos. And this is an idea originally put out by Francis Crick of DNA fame. Now, if I had put this out, I'd have been laughed out of court, but because the Nobel Prize winner of Crick status says it, people take notice. But that's a possibility. We're not saying that's what's happening, but it's a possibility.
Do you have the ability to date it? I mean, is carbon dating, would it work on these things?
No, it's far too small.
Right.
I've got this morning frog. I've not cleared my tubes yet. It's difficult to, probably impossible to date by carbon dating.
Just not enough material.
That's right.
Is there a risk of contamination then, I wonder? Is there any, a sci-fi movie version of this
that's right.
This stuff falls to Earth and, something bad happens?
Yeah, Hyland Wickramasinghe suggested many years ago that maybe diseases come from space, like SARS and so on. New diseases come from space. This is an obvious possibility. Now, my take on this is that most of these organisms, I think, are non-pathogenic. They're not going to cause the death of civilization because they've been coming in from the dot. Remember, if these organisms are coming in, they're not new to the world. They've been coming into the Earth from the early beginnings of when the Earth cooled. So they are as much part of biology as you are, as I am. They're not alien in that sense because they've been coming in. So they are biological material from space that becomes Earth-like, becomes attached to Earth, as it were.
That's one of the things that NASA has. They have some protocols that that were used to, for possible contamination during the height of the space program. They want to add some laws and rules about.
Sure. I mean, this is one of the questions people ask me: Is it from a spaceship? Are these materials coming from the space station or something? But at least theoretically, all that material that's sent into space should have been sterilized and clean, so it shouldn't be coming from there. And if it was coming from there, why isn't it pollen? Why isn't it grass? Why would it be some unusual organisms? Again, this is very important, why are we finding unusual material? It should be normal Earth material if it's coming from Earth. And this is, I think, the great kind of positive on our side that makes me think it's coming from space.
I hope this doesn't sound dumb, but would it be worth doing an experiment like attaching some kind of a filter like a fly trap to the ISS or something, or satellites to catch something
up there
too high?
Well, this is an interesting point people can look up on the internet. This time last year, August of 2014, the Russian scientists, space agency people, said that they found plankton, diatoms or plankton, on the windows of the space station, International Space Station. Now, this information went on the media and then suddenly died. We've not been able to find anything about it. There doesn't seem to be a paper published about it. NASA said it wasn't right. We wrote letters to the people involved in Russia, and we've had no replies. So it's very strange. Why they've not even said it's wrong. It's just gone quiet. Now, why is it that no one's continuing with this work of finding plankton on the International Space Station? Now, obviously, if they found plankton on there, then that certainly couldn't be coming from Earth. It must be coming from space.
Wow, that's
so
a
why
heck
have
of
they
a,
gone quiet?
Yeah. I remember reading that story. I guess maybe it's something to do with political tensions right now. It's the Russians don't trust anyone from the Western powers anymore.
Yeah, that could be the case, but we'd certainly like to hear whether that's true or false. I mean, to be just kind of left in the air is a bit annoying, but that would be certainly interesting. You could look at the surface of the space station to see if it has these organisms on it. Because one of the problems, of course, is if it's coming to the space station, it's traveling at speed, so it would be obliterated. The great thing about our work is done in the atmosphere. Now, the Earth's atmosphere slows particles down. So you could probably only do this experiment on Earth, in no other planets that don't have an atmosphere. The great thing about Earth is the atmosphere slows these particles down, so they're not obliterated. That's an important point when you're thinking about them hitting the space station.
We have a caller with a question for you, Byron in Bedford, Indiana. Hi, Byron. Sure. You're welcome to Coast. You're on with Dr. Milton Wainwright.
Mm-hmm. Always good to have you on the driver's seat, George.
Thanks.
I don't really have much of a question. I have more of a comment.
Sure.
I think that this is the best topic of all, right? The where we came from, the origins, for us to think that we're alone is crazy. And with the help of the internet, bringing us all together, it's just like we're evolving consciously, if you will, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is just a part of it. It's just a matter of time before.
Sure.
Because there's so many thousands of people claiming to be abducted and this and that, seeing ships. It's just a matter of time. It's inevitable.
Yeah, I don't get involved too much with the broader UFO question. That doesn't mean I don't take an interest in it. But, in science, you've got to limit yourself to a little bit, otherwise you'd then call it crazy or something. So we're limiting ourselves to the scientific issue of finding these organisms coming in from space. We don't speculate too much about it. Yeah. But in science, there's a thing called the tipping point. This is where all information suddenly goes to a tipping point and then goes over and a new paradigm, a new idea is introduced. And people then look back and say, well, why wasn't this obvious before? So I think this year and next year we're coming to this tipping point when life in space will be accepted.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We have Edward in Maui. Hi, Edward. You're on with Dr. Wainwright.
Hey, aloha. Just real quick, I did some research back in the 70s when I was at Evergreen College with Jonathan Ott and Jeremy Bigwood, who were contemporaries with Terrence McKenna. And one of the observations from some of the really out there people about fungal spores and these odd little psilocybin mushrooms that seem to be popping up was the observation that a fungal spore was the ultimate spacecraft and that it could travel through negative gravity, vacuum in space, and high radiation and end up sporing itself on the culture plates of the various planets. And I just wonder whether that was anything that...
That's interesting. Well, we don't find fungal spores on our, but these may be kind of similar ideas. We've also in the past been involved in this red rain phenomenon, these large showers of red rain-like organisms, organisms that appear in the rain. And these are very strange organisms, and again, there's great controversy as to whether they're from Earth or space. But yes, I mean, we've got to remember these organisms probably don't travel naked. They're in cosmic dust. They're surrounded by little bits of dust, which protects them from UV. The great problem with traveling through space is time and exposure to UV. So if you're covered in a little bit of dust, the UV is no problem. And of course, organisms can withstand temperature, high temperature, low temperatures, and they can survive for long periods. So, yeah, it's a clear possibility.
Thanks, Edward, for the call. You know, we hear that a lot about the arrogance of humans, and I guess you hear it more than anyone. I remember reading a quote of yours talking about how wrong ideas have crippled science in the past, and it seems like just the reluctance to even look at this, we're missing a great opportunity here to understand.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, I spend a lot of time working on this, and I call it a thousand bath problem because I lay in the bath thinking about this. This is a thousand bath problem. And basically, all I want to know is why it can't be correct. If somebody can tell me, and no one has yet, why this is wrong, I'd be more than delighted. I mean, I'm a scientist. I don't have a kind of religious connection with this idea. If somebody can tell me where we're going wrong, I can retire and spend my time growing flowers or something. But for the moment, nobody's telling me why we're wrong. But everybody is telling me that it's rubbish. It's, you know, whatever. And this is very annoying, particularly from scientists. You would expect scientists to have a go at being logical and being reasonable. But as I say, the big motivator now in science is money. And you cannot afford to get involved with nutters like me, right? If you're trying to get grants from granting establishments, you will just... anything to do with life in space sullies your grant applications. And of course, we've applied for grants for this work and we get nowhere. We're having to rely on a little bit of charity money, as it were, to do our research. And no one in the UK, and certainly I guess NASA, won't fund it. They may fund it themselves, but they won't give us money for it.
My gosh. You know, I'll bet you get invitations to speak at UFO conferences, and I would think that would be a death knell for you if you were to ever accept one. It would...
Yeah, I guess so. That's not because I think the UFO community is mad or anything. I think there's some very interesting phenomena going out there, and we should keep on looking at it. Yeah, again, I don't understand why the scientific community treats the UFO community like this. There's clearly lots of unusual things going off, and we should study them scientifically. I just don't understand why scientists take this view. To my mind, they're not real scientists. They're bigots, because you've got to look at everything. I mean, science is only information. It's only ideas. It's not some kind of religion, you know.
Well, I've seen it. Your biography, it says that you also researched the history of biology. I'm sure you must have seen similar kinds of things in the history of science where they... It requires a whole generation to die out, I guess, before it changes.
Right. It's almost normal, you know. I mean, anyone who's, you know, we talk about the paradigm, the current ideas. Anyone who's trying to change the paradigm, they have to be warned that they're going to meet this kind of reaction, and it's almost a kind of pathological response from human mind, I guess. People don't like change. They don't like new ideas. And of course, when the new idea is established, they say it's obvious. In fact, I did it, or, you know, everybody says, oh, it's so obvious. And looking back in history, this has happened so many times. I mean, obviously, the Galileo thing is the obvious.
Sure, right? Yeah.
But it's happened on many levels. And it's very strange to understand why, because people, I mean, your listeners will be saying, oh, scientists are wonderful, they're open-minded. But believe me, when you move to the edge, you don't find that.
Dr. Wainwright, Dr. Wilton, Milton Wainwright, we have links to your website. I hope our listeners will check it out. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you'll check back in with us when you have more information.
Well, you contact me, and we're going to keep on going, and we'll see what we get.
Well, thanks very much. You hang in there. We enjoyed the conversation. Up next, Robert Guffey, Camellio. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.